And this will be carried on by two panelists. One, the first presentation will be in a general way under cosmic evolution, and then that will proceed then to the individual human evolution. So let's consider, as regards evolution follows universal law, in their origin and in eternity, the teachings tell us that man and the universe are one with absolute unity. Moreover, every principle, every power, every faculty in operation universally has its correspondence in man. So with this in mind, in order to make sense of this idea that evolution follows universal law, in order to make the ideas practical, we're going to start off with general principles and then look at the natural, and then afterward look at the natural interrelationships among man, men, and great nature. So what of evolution? It regards as the origin of the universe. So let's first dismiss or at least temporarily suspend the idea that this grand universe is a creation of a God from nothing. So we're going to put that on the shelf for at least for this presentation and consider the idea that the universe is a series of a periodical and consecutive appearance. There is a series of periodical and consecutive appearances of the universe proceeding according to the laws of the universe. And it appears from the subjective to the objective plane of being at regular intervals of time. This covers periods of immense duration. And let's consider this as a universal process without beginning or ending. So to grasp this idea further, let's consider an analogy. We can consider, HBB gave us a great analogy, if we consider the solar year. There are 6 months of night and 6 months of polar day in the solar year. In universal terms, let's call this period of night and day of the solar year an eternity. Each cycle is its own eternity. So then there are infinite eternities in vast duration. Now in this analogy, the sun represents the universe. Each polar day and night represent a period of time that's just so inconceivably immense that we're not going to assign quantitative values to it, but it's just an inconceivably long period of time. So as the sun in this analogy rises each morning, we see it objectively on the objective horizon from subjective space below the horizon. This, we consider this day, we use the word manvantara. It's a period of manifestation. The day of Brahma is a manvantara, and the night of Brahma, we should say the word is Brahma, is pralaya. So during those nights of Brahma, during the nights, all is in all, or there is this homogeneity of all. During the days of Brahma, then the laws of differentiation proceed. The laws of differentiation are operative. So this is the process. This process of evolution is a process that is worked and guided from within outwards. Evolution is an ever becoming from within outwards. The whole cosmos is guided, controlled, and animated, we are told, by an endless series of hierarchies of sentient beings whom we can refer to as messengers in the sense that they are agents of karmic and cosmic law, not personal beings, but we can refer to them as messengers, as agents of cosmic law. So man, the microcosm of the universe, is a witness to this universal law. How so? Well, in that every external motion, act, or gesture produced by man is preceded by an internal feeling or emotion or will and mind or thought. So along this line, so we're talking about evolution and trying to grasp what it's about. When we think about this, also the word emanation applies here. We can consider that this process of evolution is an eternal reality. As an emanation, there is a reflection of the eternal reality during a period of manifestation that is cast, which we call the material universe. So in a sense, the material universe is an outward reflection of an inner reality. This is a phenomenon. It is a temporary illusion. It is the effect of an inner eternal reality. Okay, then, so how does the universe originate? How does it manifest? Well, we can consider the statement in the Gnostic Gospel that we found this in the Key to Theosophy, where HPV says that in this Gospel of St. John, it reads, "And the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not." The light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. That light, which shineth in the darkness, is the absolute as immutable law. So everything comes simply as is driven forward by immutable law, as opposed to a personal God being. This process is that the universe passes out of its homogeneous subjectivity and radiates or emanates as a manifestation, and thus proceeds the sevenfold differentiation of the universe in manifestation. Okay, so these are some of the ideas regarding the evolution of the universe, general principles. But how do we know that it's true? Well, by the law of analogy of correspondence, that's one way. And we used an example of that with the polar year and the sun. But also by the cumulative testimony and endless series of seers who testify to these teachings. Their visions, their explorations through different planes of being were systematically checked and compared one with the other. All that was not corroborated by collective experience was rejected. And only that was recorded as established truth, which was found to agree in various ages under different conditions and throughout an untold series of incessant observations. So this idea of evolution is presented to us as a proposition. It is a proposition which is a truth which is known by the knowers of it. It is known based on the observation and experience by those who have done the work to be able to observe and experience it. This process of evolution proceeds universally. It proceeds on the level of the solar system, as well as within the immortal individuality of each human being. Indeed, the very process of gestation, not only the very process of gestation of the human embryo, is not only the recapitulation of the evolutionary process on the physical plane, but that process within each embryo is one which has existed in eternity, she says, as an astral or ethereal prototype. The natural terrestrial forces worked on the mold, which contained, besides their own elements, this mold of the human embryo, contain the elements of all vegetable and future animal forms of this globe with them. Sounds like a Noah's Ark. Therefore, man's outward shell passed through every vegetable and animal body before it assumed the human shape. And so with that, this may be touched upon by the next panelist, but we're going to turn it over and we'll take a look at the microcosmic evolution. Please unmute.
This topic of evolution follows universal laws has just literally been presented, where the whole process macrocosmically has been put before us in a nutshell of a few minutes. And primarily to give us a framework by which we can study it and apply it to the spiritual evolution of a human being and humanity. So we might say this part of the talk is on spiritual evolution follows universal laws as well. So in the process, we're going to recapitulate some of the ideas mentioned, but also as we go along, apply them to our individual path of spiritual evolution and see how and why they work. So the first idea suggested is that evolution is a process that begins in spiritual unity and ends in spiritual unity. And very often the question comes up, well, if it begins in spiritual unity and it ends in spiritual unity, what's the purpose? Why bother? And the difference is it begins in spiritual unity as a state of being. All souls are fundamentally identical with the universal oversoul. It ends with a self-conscious realization of that spiritual unity. So we might say that evolution is a process by which the soul grows through experience of that to that self-conscious realization of spiritual unity. And how do we begin? Well, we begin with an intellectual concept of the proposition of universal unity and causation. So we begin in spiritual unity, but it's a concept, it's an intellectual idea. But it ends with a truer realization of the self of all and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. So it's a transformation through evolution spiritually of an intellectual understanding to an actual self-conscious realization and conviction that something is true. And that is our path of spiritual evolution. We also had the idea presented that evolution is a cycle, but it is not a, but it is a spiral, not a circle. And what that means is that at the end of the cycle of evolution, spirit and matter are raised to a higher degree than they were before. So it's not just an endless series of repetitive cycles, but an endless series of spiraling upwards into greater expression of substance and spirit or consciousness. So what does this mean in terms of our spiritual evolution? It means that our self-consciousness is transformed, expanded, unified. That's what it means for consciousness to be elevated. While at the same time, the matter or substance that the human form is composed of is refined, spiritualized, and made more conductive or more conducive to this increasing, expansive understanding of the awareness. So we might say it's not only the genius that is developing, but the instrument that is developing through the process of spiritual evolution. So spiritual evolution does not leave out the evolution of matter or a substance. They are both parts of the same process for us as human beings. Another idea we had presented to us was this idea that evolution proceeds from within and manifests outwardly. But the other half of that is it then proceeds from the objective expression and returns within. So the initial cycle of evolution is from within, outward, and then has to be completed by a process of outward going within. And how do we do that in our own individual and human path of spiritual evolution? Well, beginning within, the path of spiritual evolution as taught by the great sages of all times begins in the transformation of the mind and heart, the way we think and feel. And a result of that thinking and feeling, the body itself, under law, is transformed. The very substance, the very vehicles that we use during an incarnation is transformed by the previous effort to transform our thought and feeling. But then we are told that the final liberation and the final enlightenment through awareness of the spiritual knowledge of the unity of all has to begin without. And what does that mean? That means our effort has to be for the benefit through deeds of service and practical altruism for others, for other human beings as we find them. We cannot pursue this path apart from the collectivity of our other human beings and the duties of our ever life, our everyday life. So by doing that, we allow ourselves to tread the path to full realization of that universal knowledge. So key to spiritual evolution is not just the idea that it's an inward process, but it's an outward process of service. We do not leave our fellow human beings or any department of nature behind while in the attempt of our own spiritual evolution. The fourth idea presented was that evolution proceeds under karmic law, the law of cause and effect, action and reaction. And what this means for us is as individuals, we are all in a different stage on this path of spiritual evolution. We define it differently, we see it differently, and we practice it differently. And the stage we are at is the result primarily of our individual karma, the acts, the causes we've set up in the past, and they are expressed as effects on our mental, psychic, and physical plane of being. The other half of that is, as we are taught, that the progress of our spiritual evolution is checked by our individual karma. And why is that? Because we are currently experiencing what we might call unexpended karma. We may have the highest aspirations now, but because of the way we've acted in the past, there may be temporary obstacles and blockades in our past that we cannot completely overcome in this particular incarnation. And also, not only is there is expended karma, but we are unable to, unexpended karma, but there is karma waiting for us from the past that cannot come through because of those obstacles. So we may have achieved great things in the past, but it can't come through and be felt by us at this point or expressed because of lessons that we failed to learn or obstacles that we have set up. So we have a situation here where karma is not only the means by which we progress, but it is also the instrument through which we face obstacles. So the only solution for the individual on the path of spiritual evolution is total reliance, trust in the law of karma, which is not an outside force, but rather it is the law of our own spiritual being, the law of our being, because there is no karma unless there is a being to make it and to feel its effect. So the key to our spiritual evolution then is reliance on the law of karma. A fifth idea that we were taught is that evolution proceeds under cyclic law. And we're not going to spend too much time on this one because the whole of our preceding month of December really dealt with this issue. And it's basically the idea to recognize that the ebb and flow in the cyclic return of spiritual forces and impulses that drive or come through in a periodical way, and that these can be recognized and utilized, not only on a daily basis, but a spiritual basis, in a spiritual way. Excuse me, not only in a daily way, but in a yearly way. So the point is this, why do we take up this idea of the path of spiritual evolution in our ULT in Philadelphia at this year every time? Because it draws our attention to the fact that in this particular cycle, from the winter solstice to the vernal equinox, especially at this time of the year, the spiritual forces are on the rise. And if we direct our mind to that rise through our study of spiritual evolution, we benefit, we ride that wave so much better. A sixth idea. There are three streams of the evolutionary process: the physical, the mental, and the spiritual stream. What does this mean for us? What does it mean to be involved in this spiritual stream of evolution for a human being? For us, we might say, in any one life as we find ourselves, it is a path of union of our personal mind with our individual higher mind. In other words, we could say it another way. It's a transformation. Our spiritual evolution is a transformation where we start out with individual self-consciousness. We are aware of ourselves as individual self-conscious human beings to the point where we are individually self-conscious of the unity of all. So we no longer think of even though we are individual thinkers, we no longer identify or think of ourselves as separate spiritual beings, but as rays of one source, of one sun, of one self. That is our process of spiritual evolution. But it is not a journey that we make just throughout one life, but through many lives. And in each life, we might say, we progress as spiritual beings, as incarnating egos, to a higher degree of this awareness, of union, self-conscious union with the self. But not only do we become aware, we grow in our power and a character to use those abilities. So it's not just a growth of awareness, it's a growth of power. And so in each life, there is a spiritual harvest of all the effort we've made in that life to our collective spiritual character and power that we pass through many lives. So we might think of as a necklace, a strand of beads, and each one of those beads represents the spiritual accumulation of effort, of power, of understanding that we've garnered from any one life. But our whole understanding is represented by that necklace, by that strand of beads. So no one of us at this particular time, unless we are an adept or a Mahatma, can express the full accumulated wisdom that we've had. But any one of us can add every day, every month, every year, every life, a little bit more to that character and to that power. So in a sense, without that monad, without that Atma Buddhi, spiritual discernment, evolution could not go forward. The path of our spiritual evolution is learning to listen to and follow the voice of the silence, which is the voice of inspiration and spiritual enlightenment of our higher self, of that monadic essence within each of all. So it's one, learning to be a listener and servant of our higher self. And the other path of that spiritual evolution, which depends on that monad, as we said, is to make our thoughts and aspirations every day spiritual enough so that they can be assimilated, they can be digested, they can become part of our character in each life. So when we are incarnated in this life, we are not a blank slate. From our earliest ages, as we know, we bring forth with us an awareness, a character, which makes us unique. And that spiritual character, that spiritual awareness, is not the product of one life, but it is the accumulated effort of many lives. And it is our attempt in each life to be able to bring more and more of that wisdom and power through until we have the perfection, the flower of the perfected human being on this plane, which we call a great soul or a Mahatma. But a Mahatma is not just a great soul. A Mahatma is also a living human being, meaning that in that attempt to acquire spiritual knowledge, that soul has also raised up the instruments of the human being to the highest possible degree, physically, psychically, and intellectually. Now, these two presentations have, we think, laid a good groundwork for your questions and comments and discussion on this path of spiritual evolution that is our subject for this month of January. So your questions and comments are invited at this time.
CB.
Yes, CBW.
I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be. I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be.
Thank you. So the idea is that I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be. Well, as a question we throw out then there is, who is that I that never was not, that never ceases to be? And what is not that I? That what is the I that perishes, that's transient? What do you think? Any thoughts on that? Could we say that the I that perishes is that personality. That is a personality, a vehicle for one life. We identify ourselves, we believe ourselves to be a body with a certain temperament, with certain qualities, with certain physical, psychological features. And we identify that, we form an idea. That has its period of expression and its kalaya, just like the universe. But what endures is that thinker, that spiritual being, one with the monadic essence, a self-conscious individual spiritual being that is the immortal pilgrim from life to life. And we can say it never was not, because it is inherent. It is one with, in its spiritual essence, with that source of life, that one divine principle, the eternal root of all being.
JD?
Go ahead, JD.
Is the soul then influenced by the mind? Is the higher thinking consciousness affected, influenced by the mind / personality?
So we'll take that question, just to reword that. So then, is the mind, is higher mind, unified with Buddhi, united with Buddhi, is it influenced by the personality? Well, certainly the higher mind receives as a result of the actions of the personality all of the experiences and higher aspirations that the personality put in motion, all of the effects of the causes that are worthy of the assimilation of the higher nature. So in other words, it would seem that the higher nature is dependent upon the personality to experience this plane so that it can become self-conscious in this plane. Any other ideas along those lines?
Well,
LG.
Okay. Unmute.
Please unmute.
In Patanjali's, it is said, very puzzling statement, that Buddhi becomes conscious of itself through the accretions of the mind during incarnation and after death. So what does that mean about Buddhi becoming conscious of itself in regards to our spiritual evolution?
In order for there to be self-consciousness, there has to be a degree of mind of the thinker. In order for us to be self-conscious in the waking state, mind has to be present, inactive. The same can be said for the dream state. We know that we are thinking, observing, and we are consciously aware. But it continues in the stages after death, that for us to have self-conscious awareness, mind has to be actively present. So this Atma Buddhi, this monadic essence we spoke of, which evolution is dependent on, is a universal principle. It's present in all the kingdoms, but only in the human kingdom is it self-conscious. And we might say it becomes this immortal pilgrim, this immortal monarch, becomes self-consciously aware of the unity of all throughout a long series of evolutions in incarnation through the effort of mind in the waking state, in the life. And to the extent we use that mind in a higher way, that self-consciousness and all its experience can be assimilated by the immortal soul. So an example is given. Let's say we are the tenant of a large farm, and we send out a worker into the field to gather the crops. Well, in order for us as the owner and the tenant of that farm, in order for us to benefit, that worker not only has to gather the crop, but bring it back to us so we can accumulate it and use it. So think of the immortal pilgrim, the higher mind, if you will, as the tenant, and the lower mind, a very important vehicle by which it can individually go out in the field, contact the experience of physical life, gain the experience. But that's not enough. The lower mind has to transform it, bring those lessons, spiritualize itself enough so it can return to and be assimilated by the pilgrim soul. And that's another way of looking at that teaching of Patanjali. Now, there was a chat that came in. We did want to read a question. In going out to observe, study the world for determining how one may be of service, are there some things that would be too great of an evolutionary leap or too far removed from originator as to deserve further attention? So as to restate the question, if we are looking to be of service, if we are looking to the world, to human beings, if we are learning to want to observe, where should we look to accomplish that evolutionary progress? And is it possible that we might be going into things that are unnecessary or too much for us to do now, or not our field of inquiry? So if it's possible, the question is, what guideline can we use? Where can we place our effort to be of service to the world? Where is the best place to study for our particular stage of spiritual evolution? Remembering that we're all in different stages. So that opportunity must be different according to the stage of the soul. LG, you had your hand up.
One thought comes to our mind is that is karma. That if we go on this journey from outwardly to inwardly, we need to rely on karma. It provides some checks and balances. And maybe we could have a better understanding of what does it mean in relationship with karma and cycles and reincarnation to understand this journey, this part of our spiritual journey that takes us from the outward to the inward.
Tying that contribution back to the chat question, it's reliance on karma. And remember, in the talk, the idea was presented that our path of spiritual evolution relies on a dependency or reliance on karmic law. And karma expresses itself not only in our particular mental, psychic, or feeling nature and physical being, but also in our physical circumstances. Where we live, the family we have, the city we have, the conditions we find ourselves in, all that is karmic. And so karma is a great teacher there. And karma is sometimes, interestingly enough, substitute or an equivalent to dharma. Two very similar words. And the meanings are so subtle that our karmic opportunity is the same thing as our dharma or our duty, or our particular field of application and observation. So the best place for us to look and work and grow is where we are now. Not in a mountain, not in a forest, not in some place we imagine to be greater, but dealing with the human beings in our family, in our workplace, in our collective effort, wherever it is, our neighborhoods, our nation. That's the best opportunity for our growth. And it's, so, remember it said, that's how we begin objectively and work back to a realization of the self.
So then as regards that question, essentially it's saying, just to rephrase it, is it possible to bite off more than we can chew? And the answer really is it's on the one hand, you know, if it presents itself to the individual and it's obvious and it's yours and intuitionally you feel responsible to take some action with it, then that answers the question. But it's a judgment because there's two sides to the coin. Is it part of our dharma, whatever this situation is? You know, can we fix the world? Well, we can fix our world. We can make every effort to fix the world in which we see and operate. But it's really a judgment that we have to make the decision on whether we're going to take that bite or not.
LG.
In thinking about the fixing the world, it seems that we have to consider it from the point of view of evolution outwardly, inwardly. So as we experience the disharmony that exists in the physical world, the first changes that we have to make is within ourselves. Are we going to participate in that disharmony, or are we going to plant a different idea, a different seed? And it was once said that we could spend our whole life fighting against what we see in front of us, or we can turn around and head in the direction we want to go. So I think that that can be applied to this evolution inwardly. Let's head in the direction that we want to go and create better thought forms for the future, which I think is the dharma of humanity, is to create better thought forms for nature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another chat contribution in the phrase of a question and comment. Is the phrase you mentioned, follow the silence, similar to that teaching of listen to that still small voice within from 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 11? Old Testament wisdom reflected or congruent with the teachings of the masters to Madame Blavatsky. An overlap of Western and Eastern wisdoms, perhaps. That voice that has its origin in the threefold flame within each heart. This path of spiritual evolution is the same for all. The goal of spiritual evolution is the same for all. The path may vary with the pilgrim, where they find themselves. So it's no surprise that the true devotee of any great world religion can find within their religion these ideas expressed in a way in harmony with that temperament, that religion, because it's dealing with universal truths and processes for all human beings. And so there is an overlap between the wisdom we find in the Old Testament, or the voice of the silence, or the Bhagavad Gita, or the New Testament. These ideas transcend Eastern and Western, ancient and modern teachings. They are universal. So the final is, what is that threefold flame within each heart? What is the threefold flame? that voice that has its origin in the threefold flame within each heart. Well, let's start simple. What is a flame or a fire symbolic of? We know in all religions it refers to flames and fires, but what's that referring to?
A light comes to mind.
Spirit. We saw purity in the chat.
Purity. So the flame, pure flame or light, flames, a flame, but you're speaking here of light or heat, you're talking about force, because light is a force. A flame has a power to destroy and create, to move things. So this threefold flame within each heart has to do with the spiritual forces, the threefold or three-in-one spiritual forces within that we feel within the heart of our being. So this, we spoke of the immortal thinker, the unity, the three-in-one, Atma, Buddhi, Manas, that threefold flame or three-in-one, or Father, Son, Holy Ghost, or Trinity, whatever religion we're looking at, is that threefold flame, that threefold power that we feel more in our heart as compassion, as intuition, than we feel in our intellectual reasoning mind. It's a awareness of feeling that comes directly to us rather than through reason. We can use our reason to confirm it, but it does not depend on our reason. And it says here, the same as the Zoroastrian ideals of the fire of love, wisdom, and power. Love, wisdom, and power, you might say, are the expressions of that Atma working universally through Buddhi in every kingdom, but individually in the self-conscious human being. Only the human being, the self-conscious individual mind, can direct those universal forces of power, of love and wisdom, to their, with will and choice, to their own direction. Can use it for creative purposes in a self-conscious way.
LG has her hand up.
Well, I'm reminded of what HBB says about we err when we do too much. And oftentimes, the voice of the silence within us mostly tells us to be still. Don't do anything right now. Be still. That seems to be the most number one thing that it gives us to do. What is the importance of that stillness?
Well, there's some very interesting things about the voice of the silence. It also says, inaction is not for deva egos. But it also tells us to listen to the still, small voice within. So it's telling us two things, that our minds can be calm and still and reflective of our, and listen to the light within, the flames within, the love, wisdom, and power that comes from within, while being actively engaged and not still and not passive in the world of our waking life with other human beings. So we have that ability. And so that's spiritual evolution, or spirituality is not a passive state. It's a state of power, of willfulness, of action, not just meditative, silent, personal reflection or understanding.
So when we're in the middle of a karmic event and we feel that need to be still from within, It is so that we can better reflect the compassion through the karmic event. It is not that we don't do anything. It is that by holding that still place where the wind does not disturb it, from that place, whatever karmic event we're in, we can better reflect the higher qualities. Is that what we're saying?
Well, let's take that example of that gardener, that laborer going out in the field. And let's instead imagine it that it's a very slick, muddy field, or even an icy field. And we're trying to imagine that gardener swinging the axe or the shovel to try to get something done. And they're slipping and sliding all over the place. And the reason is they have no grounding. They have no bearing. They have no traction or steadiness or which to utilize their force. It's the same way. We find that stillness, that solidity, if we want to use that term, that changelessness within our own nature, that spiritual source to stand on while we're applying the forces of our body and mind on this fake plane. And if we don't do that, we're as effectless, is there such a word? Ineffective, ineffective as that slipping and sliding labor. We all need a foundation on which to swing our instruments. The problem for humanity is right now, our foundation is in our desires. That's what we stand on when we want to use our instruments. And as we know about desires, they're all over the place. Sometimes they're strong, sometimes they're weak. And so the result is our actions are not consistent. But if you want consistent spiritual action, then it has to be on something firmer than our passions and desires.
When we think of our actions based on the desire principle, we have to wonder about the poor elementals. They don't know what direction they're going. We're sending them off in so many different directions that it must be very difficult for them to have any kind of cohesion at all.
Well, it is said the elementals of our kingdom of nature, and they are the nerves of nature. So in a sense, the lives in the lower kingdoms are also either helped or retarded by our own spiritual evolution. And that is actually the title of not the next Sunday's topic on spirit path of spiritual evolution. So the next week next Sunday we're going to look at what is the purpose. But after that we look at the evolution or the path of spiritual evolution or evolution of the lower kingdoms. So there is a silent, hidden spiritual evolution going on in those kingdoms as well, with which we are intimately connected. And of course, we'll learn more about that in the weeks to come. One of the previous questions was, how is the soul affected by the mind? And it was addressed as understanding the soul there to represent the higher mind or the immortal thinker, and the mind there being its lower mind or its tool or intellectual instrument working through the brain. So that brings us to the subject of the higher and lower mind, which is the subject of our Wednesday class. And also to mention at this time that our class, our gathering on Friday, this coming Friday, is on sacrifices and sacrifice, which of course is an inherent part of any path of spiritual evolution. So we thank you very much for your participation, and wish you all a good day and a pleasant path in your spiritual journey.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.